and Matilda were finally given clothes, shirts that fell to the knees, and pants that were baggy and rough. Then as Major LaRoche watched, an old blacksmith put the 10 Texans in leg irons. The leg irons were heavier than the ones they had worn in Antone Chico, and the chains were too short for any of the men to take a full stride.
"Major, I could crawl to El Paso faster than I can walk on these darn ankle bracelets," Bigfoot said.
"You won't have to walk, monsieur," the major said. "We have a fine wagon for you to ride in. We want you to be rested for our little ceremony."
The fine wagon turned out to be an ox cart drawn by an old black ox. The 10 men fit in the wagon, but Matilda didn't. Gus offered to give her his place, but Matilda shook her head. "I've walked this far," she said. "I reckon I can walk on into town." Ahead, northeast of the river, they could see a gray mountain looming. Although the men were chained and the ox cart bumped along at a slow pace, the cavalrymen kept pace around it with their sabers drawn. After 2 hours of bumping along, Gus's bladder began to trouble him. But when he started to slide out of the wagon to take a piss, the soldiers leveled their sabers at him.
"All right, then, if that's the rule, I'll just piss over the side," Gus said, standing up. "I don't want to wet my new pants."
He stood up and peed off the end of the ox cart, watched by the soldiers with the sabers. In time, several of the Texans did the same. It was dusk when the cart bumped into the outskirts of El Paso. A strong wind was blowing, whirling dust into their faces. They could not see the mountain ahead or the river to the west. As night came, the wind rose higher, and the dust obscured everything. Now and then they passed little huts. Dogs barked, and a few people came out to look at the soldiers. Matilda kept her hand on the side of the ox cart. The dust was blowing so thickly that she was afraid she might lose her way and be without her companions. In the cart, the men hid their heads and waited for the journey to be over. Now and then Carl looked out for a minute. He saw a few more buildings.
"I guess they call it the Pass of the North because all this darn wind out of New Mexico blows through it," Bigfoot said. "If it gets much stronger, it'll be blowing pigs at us."
As he said it, they heard over the keening wind a faint sound that they could not identify.
"What's that?" Bigfoot asked.
Carl, whose hearing was as keen as Gus McCrae's sight, was the first to identify the sound.
"It's a bugle," he said. "I guess they're sending the army now."
Ahead through the dust, they saw what seemed to be moving lights. Soon a line of infantrymen with lanterns, led by a captain and a bugler, met the cavalrymen. The bugler continued to blow his horn, although the wind snatched the sound away almost before the notes were sounded. The soldiers with the lanterns formed a line beside the ox cart as it bumped along toward the town. One soldier, startled by the sudden appearance of a large woman at his side, dropped his lantern, which smashed on a rock. The infantry captain yelled at the soldier. Then he in turn was startled as Matilda Roberts appeared, almost at his elbow. Then he heard shouts and the sound of snarling dogs. There was a shot, and several of the cavalrymen galloped ahead. The snarling got louder. There were more shots, and then a squeal from one of the dogs. A minute later, Major LaRoche, his saber drawn, rode close to the ox cart and peered in at the Texans.
"The dogs are hungry," he said. "Stay in your wagon and you will be safe."
Then Matilda yelled.
"There's a dog got me, there's dogs all in with these horses," she cried.
Major LaRoche turned and disappeared. Bigfoot, Gus, and Long Bill Coleman managed to pull Matilda into the wagon.
"One of them dogs bit my leg," Matilda said, gasping. "I'm bloody."
Just as she said it, the black ox turned and the cart almost tipped. Three wild dogs jumped in it, snarling and biting.
"Well, this is dog town, I guess," Bigfoot said.
He managed to heave one of the dogs out of the cart. The other two, after snarling and snapping at the men, leaped out themselves. Matilda Roberts sobbed and clung to Gus. The dogs had rushed out at her so quickly that it unnerved her. Through it all, the bugler continued to play, although the snatches of sound came from farther away.
"I think that bugler's lost," Gus said. "He'd be lucky if them dogs don't get him."
The wind rose higher. Lanterns only a few feet from the wagons were hard to see. Now and then a horse neighed. So much sand had blown into the ox cart that the men were sitting in it. Sand had sifted down the men's loose clothes. It coated their hair. Then abruptly, the wind stopped. The cart had turned a corner near a high wall. The sand still swirled above the wall, but for a moment the men were protected. When they lifted their heads, sand from their hair and their collars fell inside their shirts. Through the dusty air, they saw a nimbus of light approaching. It was Major LaRoche, with a soldier beside him carrying a large lantern. The major was wrapped in a great gray cloak with a hood that came over his head. His mustache was still neatly curled. He seemed not at all affected by the storm.
"Welcome to the Pass of the North, messieurs," he said. "I have brought you to the convent of San Lazaro. In the morning, the alcalde of El Paso will be here, with his staff, to watch the little ceremony we have planned. We have a warm room waiting for you, and you will be well fed."
"When do we get to know what this ceremony is all about?" Bigfoot asked. "Might be one of those things I'd rather sleep through."
"You will not sleep through this one, Monsieur Wallace," the major said. "This is what you have walked across Texas and New Mexico for. I assure you, you would not want to miss it."
Then the major was gone, and the light with him. A gate creaked open. Several figures stood beside it in the darkness, but the sand swirled through as the cart passed inside the walls. Carl couldn't see well enough to tell whether the figures were men or women. The cart they had been traveling in was so cramped that several of the Texans had to stretch their legs slowly before they could walk. When they were all mobile, they were marched across a dusty, windy courtyard by the shadowy figures who had opened the gate. A few of the cavalrymen with their lanterns came in the courtyard with the Texans, but they stayed close to the men and avoided the dim figures who led them. All the people inside the walls were wrapped in heavy cloaks. They led the Texans across the courtyard silently. All of the figures had the cloaks wrapped closely around their faces. Bigfoot Wallace had so much sand in his boots that he found it difficult to walk. Big as his feet were, he considered them to be appendages to be cared for correctly. They had taken him across Texas and New Mexico successfully, and now they yet might have to take him farther, to Mexico City, it was rumored. Sand often contained sand burrs. He had once got a badly infected toe because he had neglected the prick of a sand burr. The others marched into the room they were shown to, but Bigfoot calmly sat down and emptied his boots, one by one. He wanted to do it outside rather than risk emptying burrs into the quarters they were being shown into. Some of the boys were nearly barefoot as it was. He didn't want to bring burrs inside where one of them could get stepped on and infect someone else. As he sat, one of the dim figures, with a very small light, a candle whose flame licked in the wind, came and stood beside him. Bigfoot was grateful for the light, small though it was. Sand burrs were small and not easy to see. He didn't want to miss any. He wiped off the soles of his feet carefully and prepared to pull his boots back on when he happened to glance toward the small, flickering light of the candle. Whoever was holding the candle cupped a hand around it to shield the flame from the puffs of wind. That, too, was considerate, but what caught Bigfoot's eye was the hand itself. The hand was the hand of a skeleton, just bone, with a few pieces of loose, blackened flesh hanging from one of the fingers. In all his years on the frontier, Bigfoot Wallace had never had such a shock. He had seen many startling sights, but never a skeleton holding a candle. He was so shocked that he dropped the boot he had been about to put on. His hands, steady through many fierce battles, began to shake and tremble. He could not even locate the boot he had just dropped. The presence holding the candle, Bigfoot was not sure he could call it a person, bent in an effort to be helpful and held the candle closer to the ground so that Bigfoot could pick up his boot. When he fumbled, the presence bent even closer with the candle. Bigfoot looked up, hoping to see a human face, and received an even greater shock, for the person holding the candle had no nose, just a dark hole. Where he had expected to see eyes, he could see nothing. A hand that was mostly bone held the candle, and the form the hand belonged to had no nose. Then the wind rose higher, and the candle flickered. Bigfoot was so shaken that he forgot the sand burrs. He even forgot his boots. He stood up and walked barefoot straight through the doorway into the room where his companions were. He almost ran through the door, running into Matilda Roberts and knocking her into Gus. There was no light at all in the room. The wind whooshed past the door and the sand blew in. Then someone outside closed the door and a key grated in the lock. When Maddie knocked Gus down, Gus fell into Long Bill. No one knew what was happening in the pitch-dark room.
"Woodrow, where are you?" Gus cried. "Someone knocked Maddie down."
"It was nobody but me," Bigfoot said. He realized at that moment that he had forgotten his boots, and he turned to go back for them, only to find the door locked. He didn't know whether to be relieved or frightened that he was inside. It was so dark he could see no one. He'd only known he shoved Matilda Roberts because none of the Rangers were that large.
"Oh, Lord, Maddie," he said. Oh, Lord, I seen something bad.
What? Matilda asked. I didn't see nothing but folks wrapped in serapes.
It was so bad, I don't want to tell it, Bigfoot said.
Well, tell it, Matilda insisted.
I seen a skeleton holding a candle, Bigfoot said. I guess they put us in here with the dead.
All night the rangers huddled in pitch darkness, not knowing what to expect. Bigfoot, when questioned, would only say that he had seen a skeleton holding a candle, and that when he looked up he had seen a face with no nose.
But how would you breathe with no nose? Long Bill asked.
You wouldn't need to breathe, Gus said. If it was just a big hole there, the air would go right into your head.
You don't need it in your head, Gus. You need it in your lungs.
What about eyes? Long Bill asked.
That's right. Didn't it have eyes? Don Shane asked. The mere sound of Don Shane's deep voice startled everyone almost as much as Bigfoot's troubling report. Don Shane, a thin man with a black beard, was the most silent man in the ranger troop. He had walked all the way across Texas and Mexico, and during hunger and cold, without saying more than 6 words, but the thought of a person with no nose brought him out of his silence. He felt he would like to know about the eyes. After all, Comanches sometimes cut the noses off their women. A barber in Shreveport had once slashed Don's own nose badly. The barber had been drunk, but a person without eyes would be harder to tolerate, at least in Don Shane's view.
I didn't see eyes, Bigfoot said, but it had a sheet wrapped over its head. There could have been eyes under that sheet.
If there were no eyes, that's bad, Long Bill said.
It's bad anyway, Gus said.
Why would a skeleton be wanting to hold a candle?
No one had an answer to that question. Call was in a corner. He took no part in the discussion. He thought Bigfoot was probably just imagining things. Gus's question was a good one. A skeleton would have no reason to light their way to the prison cell. Perhaps Bigfoot had gone to sleep in the ox cart and had a dream he hadn't quite waked out of. Skeletons were more likely in dreams than in Mexican prisons. It was true that the Mexican soldiers had seemed a little nervous when they brought them into the prison, but that could well have been because the wild dogs had attacked them. Wild dogs ran in packs. They were known to be worse killers than wolves. They sometimes killed cattle and even horses. The fact was, they were locked in until morning and wouldn't find out the truth about the skeleton until the sun came up. There was no window in the room they had been put in. When the sun did come up, they only knew it because of a thin line of light under the door. When the door opened, Major LaRoche stood there, in a fancier uniform than he had worn during the journey from Las Palomas. His mustache was curled at the ends, and he wore a different saber, one with a gold handle, and a scabbard plated with gold. Through the door, they could see a line of chairs, and 5 men with towels and razors waiting behind the chairs. In front of the chairs were small tables with wash basins on them.
"Good morning, messieurs," the major said. "You all look weary. Perhaps it would refresh you to have a nice shave. We want you to look your best for our little ceremony."
The rangers came out blinking into the bright sunlight. The wind had died in the night. The day was clear, and no dust blew. Bigfoot stepped out cautiously. He had almost convinced himself that the skeleton with the candle had been a dream. When he sat down to get the sand burrs out of his boots, he might have nodded for a moment and dreamed the skeletal hand.
"I guess a shave would be enjoyable," he said.
But before the words were out of his mouth, a shrouded figure walked up and held out the boots he had left in the courtyard last night. This time the whole company, Matilda included, saw what he had seen in the courtyard. The hand that held the boots was almost skeletal, with just a little loose flesh hanging from one or two fingers. Such flesh as there was black. The figure turned quickly, and the hood was wrapped closely around it. No one could see whether it had eyes or a nose, but all had seen the bony hand, and it was enough to stop them in their tracks. They looked, and around the edge of the large courtyard, back under the balconies, there were more figures, all of them wrapped in white sheets or white cloaks. The Texans looked at the barbers, standing behind the 5 chairs with their towels and razors. They looked like normal men, but the white figures under the balconies made the Texans feel uneasy. Long Bill did a hasty count of people in sheets and came up with 26.
"Go on, gentlemen. You'll feel better once you've been shaved and barbed," the major said.
"I guess I wouldn't mind a shave," Bigfoot said. "What worries me is these skeletons. One of them just brought me my boots."
Major LaRoche curled the ends of his mustache. For the first time that any of the Texans could remember, he looked amused.
"They aren't skeletons, Monsieur Wallace," he said. "They are lepers. This is San Lazaro, the leper colony."
"Oh, Lord," Long Bill said. "So that's it. I seen a leper once. It was in New Orleans. The one I seen didn't have no hands at all." "What about eyes?" Gus asked. "Can they see?"
Major LaRoche had already walked off, leaving Long Bill to deal with the technical questions about lepers.
"It was a while ago. I think it could see," Long Bill said.
"These can see," Bigfoot said. "It seen my boots and brought them to me."
"Yeah, but what if the leprosy is in your boots now?" Bill asked. "If you put them boots on, your foot might rot off."
Bigfoot had just started to pull on his right boot. He immediately abandoned that effort, and the boots too.
"I'll just stay barefoot for a while," he said. "I'd rather get a few sand burrs in my feet than to turn into a darn skeleton."
Gus was more disturbed than the rest of the troop by the white figure standing around the courtyard. They had a ghostly appearance to him.
"Well, but what are lepers, Bill?" Gus asked. "Are they dead or alive?" "The one I seen looked kind of in between," Long Bill said. "He was moving, so I guess it wasn't full dead, but it didn't have no hands. It was like part of it had died and part of it hadn't."
Major LaRoche had been giving his troops a brief inspection. He turned back impatiently and gestured for the Texans to hurry on out to the row of barbers.
"Come, your shaves," he said. "The alcalde will not like it if he comes here and finds you looking like shaggy beasts."
"Major, we're a little nervous about them lepers," Bigfoot admitted. "Bill here is the only one of us who has ever seen one."
"The lepers are patients here," the major said. "They will not hurt you. Those of you who stay here will soon get used to them."
"I hope I ain't staying here if it means living around people without no skin on their bones," Gus said.
The major looked at him with amusement.
"Who stays will depend on the beans," the major said. Then without explaining, he walked away.
Half the Texans sat down in the barber chairs to be shaved while the others stood watching. The warm sun felt good. So in time did the warm water the barbers used. While Carl, who was in the first group, was being wiped clean, he happened to look up to the walkway that ran around the second story of the convent. There he saw several figures, draped in white, grouped around a smaller figure. The smaller figure was dressed entirely in black. The black figure was not draped as the others were. She was veiled and gloved. Carl saw gloved hands gripping the railing of the walkway. They were small hands. He supposed the black figure must be a woman, but as he was getting up from the barber chair, the great gates to San Lazaro swung open, and a large, fancy carriage swept in, preceded and followed by cavalrymen on freshly brushed horses. Major LaRoche rushed over and spoke rapidly to the barbers, instructing them to hurry with the second group of Texans. Matilda had been given a wash basin and warm water. She washed her face and arms while the Texans were being shaved. In the carriage was a fat man in the most elaborate uniform they had seen, and four women. Cavalrymen with drawn sabers flanked the carriage, and Major LaRoche motioned an orderly to help the alcalde out. Several comfortable chairs were placed in the courtyard. The alcalde and his women sat in them, and infantrymen opened large parasols and held them over the alcalde and his ladies to protect them from the sun. The barbers, made nervous by the presence of the alcalde and under orders to hurry, did hastier work with the second group of Texans. Both Bigfoot and Long Bill suffered small nicks as the result of this haste, but it was not the hasty barbering that worried the Texans. It was what was going to happen to them next. The ceremony that Major LaRoche had mentioned to them several times was about to happen. The fat alcalde and four women, all dressed in gay clothes, had come to watch it, and yet the Texans had no idea what the ceremony might consist of. Carl noticed, though, that 10 Mexican soldiers with muskets had lined up in front of a wall in one corner of the courtyard. They stood there in the sun, holding their muskets. Near them stood a priest in a brown habit.
"They're going to shoot us," Carl said. "There's the firing squad. We should have run with the boys when they charged the river."
Bigfoot looked at the soldiers and drew the same conclusion.
"If it wasn't chained up at the ankles, we might jump the wall. One or two of us might make it out, but I figure they'd run us down in a day or two, or them dogs would eat us."
"Me, I'd just as soon be shot as to be eaten by a damn bunch of curs," Long Bill said.
"Oh, they ain't gonna shoot us.
We're supposed to be marched to Mexico City, Gus said. This here is just a show of some kind for that big Mexican.
Call was skeptical. They don't need a priest and a firing squad if it's just a show, he said.
When the last Texan was barbered, they were lined up behind the tables where the basin sat. Then the stools were removed in all but one of the tables. Major LaRoche stepped crisply toward them, carrying an earthen jar. He sat the jar on the table. It had a cloth over it, which he did not at first remove.
At last we come to the moment of our ceremony, he said. You are all guilty of attempting to overthrow the lawful government of New Mexico. By the normal laws of war, you would all be shot, but the authorities have decided to be merciful.
Merciful how? Bigfoot asked.
Some will live, and some will die, the major said. There are 10 of you, not counting the woman we will spare. But the 10 of you are soldiers, and must take the consequences of your actions.
Most of us already have, Call said. They were going to shoot them all, he was sure of that. He saw no reason to stand there and listen to a French soldier make fancy speeches at them for the benefit of a fat Mexican. The major paused and looked at him.
We started from Texas with nearly 200 men, Call said. Now we're down to 10. I'd call that punishment. I don't know what you'd call it.
There's but the fortunes of war, monsieur, Major LaRoche said. Here's how our ceremony will work. In the jar I have placed before you are 10 beans. 5 of them are white and 5 are black. Each of you will be blindfolded. You will come to the bowl and draw a bean. The 5 who draw white beans will live. The 5 who draw black beans will die. We have a priest, as you can see, and we have a firing squad. So, gentlemen, who would like to be the first to draw a bean?
There was a pause. Gus and Long Bill glanced at Bigfoot Wallace, but Bigfoot had his eyes on the nearest soldier with a musket. He was not thinking about white beans or black, not yet. He was thinking that he might try to grab a musket, shoot the major or the fat alcalde, and try to get over the wall with a few of the boys. The leg irons were the deuce to cope with, but if a few of them could get over the wall with a musket or two, at least they would have a chance to die fighting. He didn't trust the Mexicans in the matter of the beans. It might be that all the beans in the bowl were black. It was probably just a ruse to give them hope when there was no hope. Call didn't trust the beans either. But he didn't intend to stay like a coward and wait for someone to move, so he stepped forward in front of the table that held the bowl. A soldier with a black bandana in his hand stood near the table.
Ah, good. Our first volunteer, the major said.
He looked for a moment at the soldier with the bandana.
Be sure that you blindfold him well, the major said.
The bowl with the beans in it had a white cloth over it. The soldier came up behind Call and put the bandana over his eyes. He pulled it tight and knotted it quickly in place. The soldier knew his job. Call couldn't see a thing. The bandana let through no light at all. The blindfold alone did not satisfy Major LaRoche. He picked up the jar of beans, took the cloth off it, and walked around behind Call.
A blindfold can slip, he said. I'm going to hold the jar behind you, just below your left hand. When you are ready, reach in and pick your bean.
Call felt his hand bump the side of the jar. He didn't know what to expect, but he put his hand in the bowl anyway. It occurred to him that it was just a trick of some kind. There could be spiders or scorpions in the bowl, even a small snake. Bigfoot had pointed out to him that the smallest rattlesnakes were often the deadliest. Perhaps the firing squad was just for show. Immediately, though, he realized that his suspicions were foolish. In the bottom of the bowl were a few beans. There was no way to choose between them. So he took one and pulled his hand out of the bowl. The soldier immediately began to untie the blindfold.
You were brave enough to start, monsieur, and your courage has been rewarded, Major LaRoche said.
Call looked in his palm and saw that the bean was white.
You will live, the major said. Step to the side, please. We need another volunteer.
Bigfoot Wallace immediately stepped forward. Call's luck had persuaded him that there really were beans in the brown jar. He abandoned his plan to try to steal a musket and leap the wall. Mostly, through the years, in situations that were life and death, his luck had held. Call had drawn a white bean. He might also. There was no point in flinching from the gamble.
Bigfoot had a head to match his more famous appendages. The blindfold, which had been easy to knot around Call's head, would barely go around Bigfoot's. By pulling hard, the soldier assigned to do the blindfolding could just get the ends of the bandana to meet, but he could not pull it tight enough to knot it.
"We should have cut your hair, Monsieur Wallace," the major said. "The blindfold won't fit you."
"I can just squinch up my eyes," Bigfoot said. "The beans are behind me anyway. I can't see behind myself."
"Maybe not, but rules are rules," the major said. "You must be blindfolded."
He motioned to another soldier, who held the other end of the bandana. The two soldiers pressed the blindfold tightly against Bigfoot's eyes.
"I couldn't see a bolt of lightning if one was to strike right in front of me," Bigfoot said.
"The bowl is below your left hand," Major LaRoche said. "Please draw your bean."
Bigfoot took out a bean and held it in his palm. Even before the soldier dropped his blindfold, he heard a cry from one of the ladies who sat with the alcalde. When he looked in his palm, he saw that the bean was black.
"The count is one and one," Major LaRoche said.
One of the ladies sitting with the alcalde had fainted at the sight of the black bean. Two of the other women were fanning her. The alcalde paid no attention to the women. He did not seem very interested in the Texans or in the drama of life and death that was unfolding in front of him. A boil on his hand seemed to interest him more. He picked at it with a tiny knife and then wiped it with a fine white handkerchief. Bigfoot looked at the bean in his hand and then put it in his pocket. Two soldiers moved him a short distance in the direction of the wall where the firing squad waited. Bigfoot glanced back at his comrades, the Texans still waiting to draw.
"Goodbye, boys. I guess I'll be the first to be shot," he said.
As he waited, he pulled the black bean out of his pocket several times and looked at it. In his years on the frontier, he had been in threat of his life many times, from bullets, tomahawks, arrows, lances, knives, horses, bears, Comanche, Apache, Kiowa, Sioux, Pawnee. Yet his life had finally been lost to an unlucky choice of beans in the courtyard of a leper colony in El Paso. The rangers still waiting were stunned. Bigfoot, more than any other man, had led them to safety across the prairies. He had outlasted their commanders and taught them the tricks of survival. He had helped them find food and had located rivers and water holes for them. Yet now he was doomed.
"Bye, Matty," Bigfoot said, waving to Matilda. Then he had a thought.
"Will you sing over me, Matty?" he asked.
He remembered that his aunts had sung beautifully back in Kentucky long ago.
"I'll sing a song for you. I'll try to remember one," Matilda said. "I'll do it. You are a true friend to my shad."
Don Shane stepped up next and drew a black bean. Silent as usual, Don didn't speak or change expression. Quartermaster Brognoli, who was still glassy-eyed and whose head still jerked, stood at attention while being blindfolded. He drew a white bean. Joe Turner, a stocky fellow from Houston who spoke with a slow stutter, came next and drew a black bean. He and Don were marched over to stand with Bigfoot. Brognoli moved over and stood with Call. Gus stood by Long Bill Coleman. Wesley Button stood with two cousins named Pete and Roy. No one could remember the last names. Neither Wesley nor Pete nor Roy seemed inclined to advance to the table where the jar waited. Long Bill turned and looked at Gus.
"Well, do you want to go and draw?"
he asked. He himself was not anxious to step forward and be blindfolded, but the Texans' ranks were thinning. A turn could not be avoided much longer. Gus knew he ought to take a bold approach to the gamble ahead, the sort of approach he had always taken at cards or dice. But this was not cards or dice. This was life or death, and he did not feel bold. He looked at Matty, who was crying. He looked at Major LaRoche and at the fat alcalde, who was still picking at his boil.
"Woodrow went first. Maybe I'll be the last," Gus said.
"I expect you're hoping somebody will use up all them black beans before you get there,"
Long Bill said.
"The way I count it, there's two of them damn black ones left."
Gus didn't answer. He felt very frightened, and a good deal annoyed with Woodrow Call for being so quick to volunteer. If he himself had been given a moment to steady his nerves, he might have gone first and drawn the same white bean that Woodrow drew. Woodrow Call was too impatient. Everyone agreed with that. Wesley Buttons went next, while Long Bill was thinking about it. He drew a white bean. Gus and Long Bill were both chagrined that they had not stepped forward more quickly. Now Wesley was safe, but they weren't. Long Bill felt a terrible anxiety growing in him. He could not stand the worrying any longer. He bolted forward so quickly that he almost overturned the table where the jar with the beans sat.
"Calm, monsieur, calm," the major said. "There is no need to bump our table."
"Well, but I'm ready now," Long Bill said. "I want to take my turn."
"Of course, you shall take your turn," the major said.
The blindfold was tied in place and the bowl moved below Long Bill's left hand. He quickly thrust his hand into the bowl and felt the beans. Before he could choose one, though, an anxiety seized him. It gripped him so suddenly and so strongly that he could not make his fingers pick out a bean. He froze for several seconds, his hand deep in the jar. He wondered if black beans felt rougher than white beans, or whether it might be the other way around. Major LaRoche waited a bit, then cleared his throat.
"Monsieur, you must choose," he said. "Come, be brave like your comrades. Choose a bean."
Desperately, Long Bill did as he was told. He forced his trembling fingers to clutch a bean, but no sooner had he lifted it free of the pot than he dropped it. The soldier with the bandana bent to pick it up. Then he took the blindfold off and handed the bean to Long Bill. The bean was white. Pete went next. He turned his blindfolded face up to the sky as if seeking instruction before he drew. He didn't seem to be praying, but he held his face up for a moment to the warm sun. Then he drew a black bean. That left two men, Gus and the skinny fella named Roy. At the thought that he might be the last to draw, which would condemn him for sure if Roy was lucky enough to draw a white bean, Gus jumped forward almost as quickly as Long Bill had. When he put his hand in the jar, he realized that the Mexicans had not been lying about the number of beans. There were only two beans left, one for him and one for Roy. One had to be white, the other black. He pushed first one bean and then the other with his finger, remembering all the times he had thrown the dice. He always threw quickly. It didn't help his luck to cling to the dice. He took a bean and pulled his hand out, but when the soldier removed the blindfold, he could not immediately bring himself to open his eyes. He held out his hand with the bean in his palm. Everyone saw that it was white before he did. Roy went pale when he saw the white bean in Gus's palm. "I guess that does it for me," he said quietly, as if speaking to himself. But he went through the blindfolding calmly and drew the last black bean. Then he walked with a steady step over to join the men who were to die. Gus stepped in the other direction and stood by Call.
"You shouldn't have waited so long," Call told him.
"Well, you went first and nobody told you to," Gus said, still annoyed. "There were five black beans in there when you went and there wasn't but one when I went. I figure I helped my chances."
"If I had a weapon, I wouldn't have stood for it," Call said. Their five comrades were even then being marched toward the wall where the firing squad waited. As he watched, the same soldier who had blindfolded them as they drew the beans went over with five bandanas and soon had the unlucky Texans blindfolded. All that is except Bigfoot Wallace, whose head once again was too large for the blindfold that had been provided. Major LaRoche, annoyed by the irregularity, yelled at one of the soldiers behind the alcalde, who hurried into the building followed by one of the shrouded figures. A moment later, the soldier came back with part of a sheet, which had been cut up to make a blindfold.
"Monsieur Wallace, I am sorry," the major said. "A man doesn't like to wait at such a time."
"Why, Major, it's not much of a thing to worry about," Bigfoot said. "I've seen many a man die with his eyes wide open. I guess I could manage it, too, if I had to."
The men who were to live were marched over and offered the chance to exchange last words with those who were about to die. But in fact, few words were exchanged. Bigfoot handed Brognoli a little tobacco, which he had accepted from one of the men in the ox cart. Joe Turner was shaky. He gripped Call's hand hard when Call reached out to exchange a last shake.
"Matty, have you picked a song?" Bigfoot asked. "I expect a hymn would be the thing. I don't know none myself, but my ma and her sisters knew plenty."
Matilda was too choked up. She couldn't reply. Now five of the 10 boys were to be shot. Soon there would be no one left at all, of all the gallant boys she had set out from Austin with. Gus likewise was tongue-tied. He looked at Roy, at Joe, at Don Shane, at Pete, and couldn't manage a word. He shook their hands. Since they were in leg irons already, Major LaRoche had decided that their hands did not need to be tied. The five who were to live waited a moment in front of the five who were condemned, thinking they might want to send messages to their loved ones or exchange a few last words, but the five blindfolded men merely stood there, silent. Pete turned his face to the sky, as he had just before drawing the black bean.
"So long, boys," Bigfoot said. "Don't waste your water on the trip home. It's dry country out there."
The five who had drawn white beans were then moved back. The fat alcalde got out of his chair and made a speech. It was a long speech in Spanish. None of the Texans could follow it. None even tried. Their friends stood with their backs against the wall, blindfolded. When the alcalde finished his speech, Major LaRoche spoke to the firing squad. Their muskets were raised. Major LaRoche nodded. The soldiers fired. The bodies of the Texans slid down the wall. Bigfoot Wallace stayed erect the longest, but he too soon slid down, tilting as he did. He lay with his head, the head that had been too big for the blindfold, across stuttering Joe Turner's leg. Call felt black hatred for the Mexicans, who had marched many of his friends to death and now had shot five of them down right in front of them. Gus felt relieved. If he hadn't marched forward and drawn the bean when he did, he was sure he would now be with the dead. Brognoli, his head still jerking, chewed a little of Bigfoot's tobacco. When he saw the men fall, he felt a jerking inside him, like the movement of his head. He had no voice. He could not comment on the death of men, which, after all, was an everyday thing. The Mexicans brought the same ox cart with the same black ox into the courtyard and were about to begin loading the Texan's body in it, when, to everyone's surprise, a voice was raised in song from the balcony above the courtyard. It was a high voice, sweet and clear, yet not weak. It carried well beyond the courtyard, strong enough to be heard all the way to the Rio Grande, Gus thought. Everyone in the courtyard was stilled by the singing. The alcalde had been about to get in his carriage, but he stopped. Major LaRoche looked up, as did the other soldiers. There were no words with the sound, merely notes, high and vibrant. Matilda stopped crying. She'd been trying to think of a song for Bigfoot Wallace, but a woman was already singing. For Bigfoot and the others, a woman with a voice far richer than her own. The sound came from the balcony where the woman in black stood. It was she who sang for the dead man. She sang and sang with such authority and such passion that even the alcalde dared not move until she finished. The sound rose and swooped like a flying bird. Some of the tones brought a sadness to the listeners, a sadness so deep that Call cried freely, and even Major LaRoche had to wipe away tears. Gus was transfixed. He liked singing himself and could bawl out a tune with the best of them when he was drunk, but what he heard that day, as the bodies of his comrades were waiting to be loaded into an ox cart, was like no singing he had ever heard, like none he would ever hear again. The lady in black gripped the railing of the balcony as she sang. As she was finishing her song, the notes dipped down low. They carried a sadness that was more than a sadness at the death of men. Rather, it was a sadness at the lives of men and of women. It reminded those who heard the rising, dipping notes of hopes that had been born and yet died, of promise and the failure of promise. Gus began to cry. He didn't know why, but he couldn't stop. Not while the song continued. Then after one long, low tone that seemed to hang soft as the daylight, the lady in black ended her requiem. She stood for a moment, gripping the railing of the balcony. Then she turned and disappeared. The alcalde, as if released from a trance, got into his carriage with his ladies. The carriage slowly turned and went out the gate. "My lord, did you hear that?" Gus asked Call.
"I heard it," Call said.
The soldiers, too, had come to life. They had begun to load the bodies in the ox cart. Matilda came over to where the five survivors stood.
"We ought to go with them boys," she said. "They're our people. I want to see that they're laid out proper in their graves."
"Go ask the major if we can help with the burying," Call said to Gus. "I expect if you ask him, he'll let us. He likes you."
"Come with me, Matty," Gus said. "We'll both ask."
The Alcalde had stopped a moment to have a word with Major LaRoche, who stood by the gate. Through the gate, Gus could see the long, dusty plain to the north. The Major saluted the Alcalde and bowed to his women. The carriage passed out. The ox cart, with the bodies of the Texans in it, was creaking across the courtyard toward the same gate.
"We'd like to help with the burying, Major," Gus said. "They was our friends. We can't do much for them now, but we'd like to be there."
"If you like, monsieur," the Major said. "The graveyard is just outside the wall. Follow the cart and return when the work is finished."
Gus was a little startled that the Major meant to send no guard.
"I suggest you hurry back," the Major said with a look of amusement. "The dogs here are very bad. I don't think you can outrun them with those chains. We saw a few of them last night, but there are many more. If you try to escape, you'll soon meet with the dogs."
Matilda could not get the singing out of her mind. She wished Bigfoot could know what wonderful singing there had been after his death and the death of the others. She tried to get a good look at the woman in black, but the veils were too thick and the distance too great.
"I never heard singing like that, Major," Matilda said. "Who is that woman?"
"That is Lady Carrie," the Major said. "She is English. You will meet her soon."
"What's an English lady doing in a place like this?" Gus asked. "She's farther off from home than we are."
Major LaRoche turned as if tired of the conversation and motioned for one of the soldiers to bring his horse.
"Yes, and so am I," Major LaRoche said as he prepared to mount. "But I am a soldier, and this is where I was sent. Lady Carrie is here because she is a prisoner of war, like yourselves. I will tell my men to let you help with the burial. I suggest you pile on many, many rocks. As I said, the dogs here are very bad, and they don't have much to eat."
Gus motioned to the others. They all filed out behind the ox cart. As soon as they were out the gate, Major LaRoche and his 10 cavalrymen galloped out and were soon enveloped in the dust their horses' hooves threw up.
"I asked about that woman who done the singing," Gus told Call. "The Major says she's a prisoner of war, like us."
Call didn't answer. He was looking at the bodies of his dead comrades. Blood leaked out of the bottom of the crude ox cart, leaving a red line that was quickly covered by blowing sand.
"Lord, it's windy here, ain't it?" Wesley Button said.
The Mexican soldiers were glad to allow the Texans to bury their comrades. One of the soldiers had a bottle of white liquor, which he handed around among his friends. Soon the Mexicans were so drunk that all but one of them passed out in the ox cart. None of them had weapons, so it made little sense to think of overpowering them and attempting to escape, though Woodrow Call considered it. Gus saw what direction his friend's thoughts were taking and quickly pointed out what the Major had said about the dogs.
"He said they'll eat us if we try to run with these chains on," Gus said.
"I don't expect to be eaten by no cur," Call said, but he knew the Major was probably right. Packs of wild dogs could bring down any animal less fierce than a grizzly bear.
Matilda Roberts had saved a broken piece of tortoise-shell comb through the long journey. She was attempting to comb the dead men's hair while the Mexican soldiers finished the bottle of liquor. The Texans were laid in one grave by the walls of San Lazaro. A dust storm had blown up. When they began the burial, they could see the river, but the river was soon lost from view. Once the graves were covered, the Texans stumbled around, gathering rocks. Several dogs had already gathered. Gus and Wesley threw rocks at them, but the dogs only retreated a few yards, snarling. While they worked, another smaller cart, drawn by an old mule, made its way around the wall. It, too, was a vehicle of burial. On it were the bodies of two lepers, wrapped tightly in white shrouds. The cart passed close to where the Texans were working. The person driving the cart was also shrouded.
"Look, it's that one without no meat on his fingers," Gus said.
All that was visible of the driver was the same two bony hands that had given Bigfoot his boots only a few hours earlier. The leper did not look their way, nor did he make any pretenses. He merely tipped them out of the cart and turned the cart back toward the gate. Soon the dogs were tearing at the shrouds. The sight saddened Matilda even more. She didn't imagine that they could find enough rocks to make the bodies of Bigfoot and the others safe for very long. Call led the ox back into San Lazaro. Most of the Mexican soldiers were sleeping in the ox cart. One would have thought them as dead as the Texans but for the snores. The two soldiers who could still walk kept close to the Texans for fear of the dogs. Once inside the gates, the Texans, though still chained,
were allowed the freedom of the courtyard. They were served a simple meal of beans and pozole on the table where the jar they had drawn from had been set. An old man and an old woman served them. Both were lepers, yet neither was shrouded, and the dark spots on their cheeks and arms looked no worse to the Texans than bad bruises. Both seemed to be kindly people. They smiled at the Texans and brought them more food when they emptied their dishes. The only soldiers left in San Lazaro were the drunks in the ox cart. In mid-afternoon they began to awake. When they did, they picked up their weapons and drove the ox cart out of the walls. All of them looked frightened.
"They're scared of them dogs," Gus said. "Why don't the Major get up a dog hunt and kill the damn curs?"
"There'd just be more," Carl said. "You can't kill all the dogs." He watched the lepers as they came and went at their tasks. All of them kept themselves covered, but now and then a wind would riffle a cloak or blow a shawl so that he could glimpse the people under the wraps. Some were bad. No chins, cheeks that were black, noses half eaten away. Some limped from deformities of their feet. One old man used a crutch. He had only one foot. There were a few children playing in the courtyard. All of them seemed normal to Call. There was even a little blonde boy, about 10, who showed no sign of the disease. Some of the adults appeared to be not much worse than the old man and the old woman who served them. Some had dark spots on their cheeks and foreheads, or on their hands. Once the soldiers were gone, San Lazaro did not seem a bad place. Many of the lepers looked at the Texans in a friendly way. Some smiled. Others, whose mouths were affected, covered themselves, but nodded when they passed. Overhead, the dust swirled so high they could barely see the mountain that loomed over the convent. Gus felt such a relief at being alive that his appetite for gambling began to return. He had ceased to mind the lepers much. At night they might be scary, but in the daylight the place they were in looked not much worse than any hospital. He began to wish he had a pack of cards, or at least some dice, though of course he had not one cent to gamble with. "I wonder how long the Mexicans mean to leave us here," he asked. Brañoli's head was going back and forth like the pendulum of a clock, as it had ever since his fright in the canyon. He watched the lepers with dispassion, and the little blonde boy with curiosity. Once he looked up at the balcony where the lady in black had been, and saw a short, stout woman standing there. She spoke, and the little blonde boy reluctantly left his play and ran upstairs. Call was thinking about a way to rid them of the leg irons. If he had a hammer and a chisel of some sort, he felt certain he could break the chains himself. The Major had said nothing of coming back, and the last of the soldiers had gone. They were alone with the lepers. The only impediments to their escape were the chains and the dog packs. If he could get the chains off, there would be a way to brave the dogs. Wesley Buttons, though he had held up bravely during the long march and the drawing of the beans, was feeling keenly the loss of his two brothers and of the rest of the troop.
"I remember when we left, I got to drive the wagon with old General Lloyd in it," he said. "We had an army. There was enough of us to hold off the Indians and whip the Mexicans. Now look, there's just us, and we're way out here in the desert, locked in with these sickens." "It's a long way home, I reckon," he added. "Ma's going to be sad when she hears about the boys."
Brañoli's head swung back and forth, back and forth.
"I barely know which way is home," Long Bill said. "It's so dusty it's all I can do to keep my directions. I guess I could go down river, but it would be a pretty long walk."
Gus remembered that it was the same river they had camped on when Matilda caught the big green snapping turtle.
"Why, if it's the Rio Grande, we could just stroll along it easy," he said. "Mattie could catch us turtles when we get hungry."
Mattie shook her head. She didn't welcome the prospect of another long walk. "It's just the six of us got across New Mexico," she pointed out. "If we have to walk the rest of the way, I doubt any of us will make it. That big Indian knows that river. He might get us yet." "We'd have to have weapons," Carl said. "None of us would make it without weapons."
"I don't see what the hurry is," Gus said. "We've had a long hike as it is. I'd like to laze around here and rest up myself. These lepers ain't bothering us. All you got to do is not look at them too close."
He had been inclined to try escape until Matilda had mentioned Buffalo Hump. Memory of the fierce Comanche put a different slant on such a trip. Better to stay here inside the walls of San Lazaro and rest with the lepers than to expose themselves to Buffalo Hump again, especially since they only had 5 men.
I want to leave if we can get these chains off, Call said. What if the Major comes back and has us draw some more beans?
He was tired, though, and didn't urge escape immediately. When the wind was high, his back still sometimes throbbed, and his sore foot pained him. A day or two's rest wouldn't hurt. At least it wouldn't if the Mexicans didn't decide to eliminate them all. As the evening wore on, the Texans rested and napped. They had been assigned the little room where they had spent the night before, but no one really wanted to go into such a dark hole. The courtyard was sunny. Those who didn't want sun could rest under the long barricades. Gus was determined to gamble. He had asked several of the Mexicans who worked in the convent if they had any cards. One woman with only 3 teeth took a shine to him and managed to find an incomplete deck. It was missing about 20 cards, but Gus and Long Bill soon devised a game. They broke a few straws off a broom to use for money. While they were making up rules for a card game involving only 33 cards, a black woman, taller than Gus, came across the courtyard. She didn't seem to be a leper. Her face and hands were normal. She approached them in such a dignified manner that the men straightened up a little. Gus hid the cards.
"Gentlemen, I have an invitation for you," the negress said in English better than their own. "Lady Carrie would like to ask you to tea."
"Ask us to what?"
Gus asked. He was taken by surprise. Although he had just shaved the day before, the dignity and elegance of the black woman made him feel scruffy.
"Tea, gentlemen," the negress said. "Lady Carrie is English, and in England they have tea. It's like a little meal. Lady Carrie's son, the Viscount Mountstuart, will be taking it with us. I'm sure you've seen him playing with the Mexican children. He's the one who's blonde."
Call, too, was startled by the black woman's courtesy and poise. He had never seen a negress so tall, much less one so well-spoken. Few black women in Texas would dare to speak to a group of white men so boldly, and yet the woman had not been rude in any way. She had an invitation to deliver, and she had delivered it. Like Gus, he felt that the few rangers left were a rugged lot hardly fit to take food with an English lady. While he and Gus and Wesley and Long Bill were looking at one another, a little uncertain as to how to respond, the black woman turned to Matilda Roberts and smiled.
"Miss Roberts, Lady Carrie knows you've traveled a long way across a dusty land," the negress said. "She was thinking you might appreciate a bath and a change of clothes."
Matilda was surprised by the woman's serenity.
I would.
"Mainly I've just had a wash in the river when we were by the river," Matilda said.
"That river comes out of the mountains," the woman said. "I expect it's cold."
"Ice cold," Matilda confirmed.
"Then come along with me," the negress said. "Lady Carrie has a tub, and the water is hot." "These gentlemen can wait a few minutes. Tea will be served in about half an hour."
Matilda looked a little uncertain, but she followed the black woman across the courtyard and up the stairs.
"I wonder what kind of meal it will be," Wesley Button said. "I hope it's beefsteak. I ain't had no beefsteak in a good long while."
"For it to be beefsteak, there'd have to be cattle," Gus remarked. "I ain't seen no cattle around here, and I don't know how a cow would live if there was one. It would have to eat sand, or else cactus. If it wasn't quick, the darn dogs would get it."
A problem they considered as they waited for it to be time to go to Lady Carrie's was that Brognoli's condition seemed to be getting worse. He turned his head more and more rapidly, back and forth, and he had begun to drool. Now and then he emitted a low, thin sound, a sound such as a rabbit might make as it was dying. A little later, the black woman appeared on the balcony above them and motioned for them to come.
Gus had doubts about taking Brognoli, but it seemed unfair to leave him since food was being offered. It was true that the Mexicans who ran San Lazaro had been generous with soup and tortillas, but Wesley Buttons had put the notion of beefsteak in their minds. It seemed wrong to exclude Brognoli from what might be a feast.
"Come on, Brog," Gus said. "That lady that did that singing over Bigfoot and the boys is up there waiting to give us grub."
Brognoli got up and came with them, walking slowly and still swinging his head. None of them knew what to expect as they went up the stairs and along the narrow balcony that led to Lady Carrie's quarters. Gus kept brushing at his hair with his hands. He had meant to ask Maddie for her broken comb, but forgot it.
Of course, he had not expected Matilda to be led away by a tall black woman who spoke better English than any of them. Suddenly, the little blonde boy jumped out of the shadows, pointing a hammerless old horse pistol at them.
"Are you Texans?"
"I am a Scot," the boy said.
"Well, I'm part Scot myself," Gus said. "That's what my ma claimed. You're as far away from home as I am."
"But that's why my mother wants to see you," the boy said. "She wants you to take us home. She told me we could leave tomorrow, if you would like to take us."
Call and Gus exchanged looks. The little boy was handsome and frank. Perhaps he was merely fibbing, as children will, but there was also the chance that his mother, Lady Carrie, had told him some such thing. Call didn't mean to stay a prisoner of the Mexicans long, but neither had he expected to leave in a day.
"If we were to take you home, what would we ride?" he asked. "Our horses got stolen a long time back."
"Oh, my mother has horses," the boy said. "There's a stable in the back of the leprosarium."
"In the back of the what?" Gus asked.
"The leprosarium. Aren't you lepers?" the little boy asked. "My mother's a leper. That's why I never get to see her face. But her hands are not affected yet. She can still play the violin quite well, and she's teaching me. When we get home, I shall have the finest teacher in Europe," he added. "Some day I may play before the Queen. My mother knows the Queen, but I haven't met her yet. I'm still too young to be presented at court."
"Well, I'm not as young as you. I'd like to meet a queen," Gus said, "especially if she was a pretty queen."
"No, the queen is fat," the little boy said. "My mother was beautiful, though, until she became a leper. She was even painted by Mr. Gainsborough, and he's a very famous painter."
Just then a door opened and the tall negress stepped out. "Now, Willie, I hope you haven't been pointing that gun at these gentlemen," the woman said. "It's very impolite to point guns at people, particularly people who might become your friends."
"Well, I did point it, but it was just in fun," the boy said. "I couldn't really shoot them because I have no bullets."
"That doesn't make it less impolite," the woman said. Then she looked at the group. "Of course, I've been impolite, too," she said. "I failed to introduce myself. I'm Emerald."
"She's from Africa, and her father was a king," the boy said. "She's been with us ever so long, though. She's been with us even longer than Mrs. Chubb."
"Now, Willie, don't bore the gentleman," Emerald said. "Tea is almost ready. You may want to come in and wash your hands."
"We washed once when they barbered us," Gus pointed out. "It's been quite a few months since we washed twice in one day."
"Yes, but you are now under the protection of Lady Carrie," Emerald said. "You may wash as often as you want."
"Ma'am, if there's grub, I'm for eating first and washing later,"
Wesley Button said.
"I've not had a beefsteak for a while. I feel like I could eat most of a cow."
"Goodness, you don't serve beefsteak at tea," Emerald said. "Beefsteak belongs with dinner, never with tea. Lady Carrie is quite unconventional, but not that unconventional, I'm afraid." The Texans were led into a room where there were five wash basins. The water in the basins was so hot that five columns of steam rose into the room. There were also five towels, and more extraordinary still, five hair brushes and five combs. The brushes were edged in silver, and the combs seemed to be ivory. At a slight remove was another table, with another wash basin, a towel, and another silver-edged brush and ivory comb.
"That's the hottest water I've seen since we left San Antonio," Gus remarked. "We'll all scald ourselves if we ain't careful."
The sixth wash basin was for Willie, the young Viscount. The Texans were left to scrub themselves after their own inclinations, but while they were watching the water steam in the wash basins, a short, fat woman in gray clothes burst through a door and grabbed Willie before he could elude her.
"No, no, Mrs. Chubb,"
Willie said, trying to squirm out of her grip, but his squirming was in vain. In a second, Mrs. Chubb had Willie bent over his own wash basin. She gave his face a vigorous scrubbing, ignoring his protests about the scalding water.
"Now, Willie, try not to howl. You'll upset our guests," Mrs. Chubb said.
She didn't take her eye or hands off her young charge until she considered him sufficiently washed. Once her task was done to her satisfaction, the young boy's face was red from scrubbing and his hair shining from a skillful application of comb and brush. Then the plump woman surveyed the Texans with a lively blue eye.
"Here, gentlemen, your water's cooling. Plunge in," she said. Lady Carey has a glorious appetite, and your Miss Roberts is eating as if she's been starved for a month.
2 months, Long Bill said. Maddie ain't had a good meal since we crossed the Brazos.
Well, she's having a splendid high tea right now, Mrs. Chubb said.